This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What role do guns from the United States play in the ongoing crisis of violence in Mexico? At least 70% of firearms found in crime scenes in Mexico can be traced to the U.S. That's according to the Department of Justice's Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. 250,000 people crossed the southern border in the U.S. in December of last year. The majority of those people were from Mexico. Reuters pulled survey data from the Kino Border Initiative, that's a large migrant shelter in Nogales, Mexico, and that data suggests that violence and not economic factors are forcing many families to leave Mexico. How can understanding the violence in Mexico help us understand the migrant crisis, and what work is being done to stop the flow of guns into Mexico? We get into those questions and more after the break. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. Back with more in a moment.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Integrative Therapeutics, with vitamins and supplements previously available only through practitioners, including Cortisol Manager. Unlock your best self with clinician-curated supplements from Integrative Therapeutics, now on Amazon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Squarespace. Measure your end-to-end online performance with powerful website and seller analytics. Get insights on top traffic sources, understand how your reach is growing, and more. Use code NPR to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Let's get into the conversation. Joining us in studio is Yeva Yusonide. She's an anthropologist and former paramedic. She's also the author of Exit Wounds, How America's Guns Fuel Violence Across the Border. Yeva, welcome to the program.
Pleased to be here.
And joining us from El Paso, Texas, is Angela Cocherga. She's news director and correspondent at KTEP at University of Texas in El Paso. That's El Paso's NPR station. Angela, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Yeva, you begin the book with a story from your time as a medical volunteer at the border in Nogales. You've also worked as a paramedic and EMT at the border. How did you arrive on this topic?
On the topic of gun violence? Mm-hmm. So I was back almost a decade ago in 2015, I began working on the border as an EMT and paramedic volunteer, but also writing my previous book, Threshold. I was trying to understand how our border militarization affects border communities and what migrants who get injured. And I met a lot of people who were telling me that they were fleeing violence, not necessarily themselves. Some of them did not have like gunshot wounds as I was used to seeing in our urban communities and in Boston or Jacksonville, where I was a paramedic before. But the kind of violence they were fleeing from was all gun violence. There was extortion and there was kidnapping, various threats, forced recruitment to organized crime. So I thought that it matters for us to not only see what is coming into the United States, what is migrants, asylum seekers. Also, we are talking a lot about drugs coming into the United States, but we kind of don't look at what is going the opposite way, which is the guns from Arizona back then where I was, but also Texas and other parts of the country. So that's how I got started.
Angela, you've covered gun smuggling and violence at the border for years. How have you seen this issue evolve just in the last decade?
Well, just across the border from where I am, El Paso, our sister city is Juarez, and we went through years of extreme violence as two cartels really fought over smuggling routes. And there was a lot of human beings, everyday people being killed as they had running gun battles. Or we had young people in areas that were fighting over street sales of drugs, and they were killing each other. Very young people, 14, 15, 16. And also at the same time, we saw people, migrants who are coming through here are telling me they're encountering gun violence as they're threatened and moved through smuggling routes by groups that not only smuggle drugs, but now have a lot of profits from human smuggling as well.
We got this email from Karen who says, I worked at UPS here in Louisville in 2011 and 2012. During that time, I saw regular shipments of guns from a gun dealer in Texas, I believe it was El Paso, that went to Mexico City on a weekly basis. I knew they were guns because I didn't try to conceal it. They were in wooden crates, and when I asked my supervisor about it, he brushed it off and said to forget it. Now, the Mexican government estimates 500,000 guns are smuggled in from the U.S. each year, Angela. How are these guns trafficked? What does that process look like?
Well, often it's a very small scale. What in Mexico they'd call tráfico hormiga, like little ants moving things across the border. But they all add up. And by small scale, we mean, you know, there aren't giant shipments, but there are lots of guns. I mean, just this and ammunition, which, of course, is needed. Just this past week, U.S. Customs and Border Protection found over 2,000 rounds in this one woman's vehicle in her trunk, actually 3,600 rounds of ammunition hidden in her trunk, headed to Mexico. And that's just happened to be caught because they were doing one of their southbound checks where they periodically check, not often, what people are taking into Mexico. And this is the U.S. government, not the Mexican government, doing these checks.
What types of guns, Yeva, are being smuggled into Mexico?
All types of guns, but the primary interest in Mexico is for semi-automatic rifles that we have here, so all kinds of AR-15 varieties, AK-47s, also 50 caliber Barretts, which are these large guns that we use in war zones. Pistols, too, so people smuggle pistols, both organized crime groups smuggle pistols, but also people who want to get them for self-defense. Mexico regulates what kind of caliber pistols as well as rifles you can get, so most 9mm, for example, are prohibited in Mexico. There are also special models that some individuals in Mexico particularly desire because some companies in the U.S., like Colt, they manufacture these guns specifically for Mexican markets. They brand them with Mexican national symbols, and they are very appealing to Mexican buyers.
Now, the Mexican government filed a lawsuit against a group of U.S. firearms manufacturers in 2021. Yeva, what did they argue in that lawsuit?
Well, they are saying that the violence in Mexico is the direct result of negligent practices of U.S. gun manufacturers. So there are a lot of them, Smith & Wesson and Barrett and Colt and some others. But they knowingly sell it to dealers who have very bad track records of their guns ending up in the hands of organized crime groups and being used in violence in Mexico. So they are saying there is a direct connection. And like we saw with big pharma or big tobacco in the past, that the companies have to take responsibility for what their guns basically are doing in another country, in Mexico in this case.
Now, earlier this year, a U.S. appeals court revived the Mexican government's case, and that's after it was dismissed in 2022 by a federal court due to the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, that's sometimes referred to as PLACA. And that act protects gun makers from liability for the unlawful use of their products. During the appeals process, the courts decided that PLACA does not apply. So, Yeva, what happens next?
Well, now we'll see. Hopefully we'll go into the discovery stage. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know back and forth between these appeals, but basically it's moving forward. So, time will tell.
Angela, what challenges do ATF, border security, local police face when trying to curb the trafficking of guns across the border?
Well, it's hard to track because, Texas sells a lot of guns, and not just in gun shops, but also at gun shows. And, you know, people have the right to go, and if they don't have a criminal background, they can buy guns. And so there is those so-called straw purchases where individuals go and buy guns. They pass a background check, and then they turn those guns over to others who, you know, are taking them to Mexico or actually, you know, are part of Mexican criminal groups. And so it's hard to track. They have been able to find some of these smuggling rings that way, but it's, you know, it's piecemeal. And a lot of the people doing this, you know, are paid not that much, and just, you know, many are often women or people who are, you know, vulnerable financially, and they see it as a quick way to make some money until they realize it's a very serious crime.
We want to mention that we reached out to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives about participating in this conversation, and we didn't hear back from them, but the offer still stands. Yeva, broadly speaking, why do you think it's important for people in the U.S. to understand the role that guns from this country play in Mexico?
I think for two reasons. So one is gun violence is a huge problem in the United States. But when we are talking about it, we kind of forget that it's not only in the United States that American guns are kind of committing violence in Mexico, in Haiti, in Central America, in other countries. And I think it's important to have that part, include that into our conversation. But another thing is that we need to connect the dots. Like, we need to understand that we are seeing so many people fleeing violence, asking for asylum on our borders because of the guns going south. There's a connection. And there's also the connection with drug addiction in the United States and who is providing the drugs and why they need the guns from the United States. So I think we need to kind of see this as a regional problem that involves United States and Mexico and maybe other countries as well. Understand all the failed policies that led us to this.
Angela, in your reporting, how often do you hear people, especially public officials, connecting those dots?
Not often. And I would say I hear directly from the people fleeing, you know, as they're either being taken into custody or on the Mexican side before they cross or once they're in the U.S., making that very point that Yeva did, that they have to leave because, you know, there were a couple of fishermen a few years ago who said, we can't fish anymore. We're being extorted and they're threatening us with guns. We can't make a living. So the dots between violence and migration, those seem very clear, and they're very clear for the people who are fleeing. You also see migrants waiting on the border from other countries who talk about gun violence. I interviewed someone a couple weeks ago who said he had been pistol whipped by a group. So it's very, very serious.
Let's pause here. Coming up, we take a closer look at how violence in Mexico affects the lives of its citizens. Stay with us. We've got a lot more still ahead.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Now, Yeva, I want to turn back to your book. You spoke to many people affected by gun trafficking, from smugglers to victims of gun violence. Is there a particular story that stands out to you?
I think the one that keeps me awake at night is the one I tell about Samara, who she was a young woman when I met her, but her story began when she was much younger, a teenager. Her parents moved to Texas, so the story is about migration as well. But she was forcefully recruited into organized crime when she was 15, and she was taken to a training camp. She was working for this one major organized crime group that was the Zetas back then, and had a very, very violent few years. At the same time, I met someone else in the same city where Samara grew up, on a different part of the city, much more prosperous part of the city, Miguel. And he was one of these business owners who had to stop delivering supplies to some of their clients because the cargoes they would send on the roads would get stolen. So he smuggled guns from the United States for himself to protect himself against potential kidnapping and organized crime. So it was very interesting for me to see how these stories connect, of how violence affects different people, but how guns from the United States play the role in all of them.
What did you learn about the amount of control criminal organizations have over the daily lives of people in Mexico?
So that really depends on where in Mexico we are talking about. There are some regions like Guerrero or Tamaulipas where organized crime has much more power because they work together with the local police and even some state authorities. So there is the boundary between government structures and organized crime has always been porous in Mexico, and it is worse in some parts of Mexico than in others. The police sometimes let their own guns be stolen or give them to organized crime groups. They are the ones who participate in helping to extort people on behalf of organized crime groups, and people can't turn to police for protection. So that's part of this whole story about insecurity. They really can't turn to justice where they live.
Angela, as we said, escaping violence has become one of the main reasons people are fleeing Mexico, and you're reporting from El Paso, Texas. What have you heard from people there about how violence in Mexico has affected their lives?
Well, yeah, on both sides, because we have family ties on both sides, people are very concerned about gun violence, and we've seen the results of it during the very violent years in Juarez, but still every single day when we hear about crimes in Juarez, there's no lack of firearms. If people want a gun, they can get one fairly easily. And you know, Yeva can explain in more detail, but really Mexico has some of the strongest and tightest gun enforcement laws in the world. And yet it's awash with weapons of all kinds.
What are gun laws like in Mexico, Yeva?
In the early 1970s, Mexico passed this federal firearms and explosives law that basically determined what kind of people, what kind of guns, and how many under what conditions can have. So most Mexicans can only have one pistol for self-defense of small calibers, .22 or .380. Only people who belong to hunting groups, clubs, gun clubs, they can have certain kinds of rifles, up to 10 guns all in total. They have to register them every year. But the kinds of weapons that we see mostly trafficked across the border, the AK-47 varieties, AR-15 varieties, those are reserved for exclusive use of the army, the police, and the Air Force in Mexico. So those are not available for regular citizens.
And what do officials in Mexico say about the difficulty they have in enforcing the laws they already have on the books?
Yeah, that is a big problem. They definitely enforcing gun laws is not the main priority of the Mexican government, considering that so many homicides never get solved or thefts. A lot of crimes are not even reported in Mexico. However, they have been using this charge of people possessing firearms reserved for the exclusive use of the military to charge members of gangs or organized crime groups, any youths they pick up without actually investigating their involvement in organized crime or opening up real criminal investigations. They just get charged with weapons charges and they go to prison. And I met a lot of people like that.
Angela, what challenges do you face as a reporter in getting a complete picture of crime and how it's affecting people, both in Texas and in Mexico?
Well, it's difficult because, as Yeva said, a lot of these crimes aren't prosecuted, so we don't have good data. But we have on the ground reporting every day. We see people impacted and victims. And some of these are not just, you know, day-to-day armed robbery or that type of thing, but more even massacres. I mean, a very notorious one a few years ago was at a birthday party in Ciudad Juarez where 15 teens were gunned down. And these were street gangs carrying out, they thought they were going after rivals. They were actually going, they made a mistake. And so that was in 2010, still not fully prosecuted. And those crimes, the large scale mass shootings, not random, but, you know, targeted and then by mistake, are becoming more common across Mexico. And reporting on them are very difficult. Fortunately, in Ciudad Juarez, we had the freedom and have the freedom, except for personal safety, but we're not like in the state of Tamaulipas, where it's a virtual zone of silence. Journalists there cannot report on things. So often it's social media and people who are recording and sharing via social media, running gun battles in that state, telling people don't go out today, don't take your kids to school because it's dangerous right now.
Angela, how does the demand for drugs in the U.S. connect to this issue?
Yeah, these do go hand in hand. The other one is the movement of bulk cash back and forth across the border, and so it is this triangle of death and profits. So there was a case a few years ago where street gangs on the U.S. side, a gang that had members on both sides, were getting paid in drugs. This was a prison gang, the Barrio Azteca, getting paid in drugs by drug traffickers, and they were providing guns. So it was an even and very profitable arrangement for them. So, the drugs come in often through ports of entry now, international bridges, small-scale fentanyl, and that's the way a lot of the guns are also being moved, through these ports of entry, because, again, we don't see Mexico doing extensive checking of who's bringing what into the country. So it's a very deadly equation.
Let's head to a quick break here. When we return, Mexico's police and military have been accused of human rights violations. What role have imported guns played in those offenses? Back with more in a moment.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Instead of scrolling mindlessly, engage mindfully with the NPR app. With a mix of on-demand news, stories from this station, and your favorite podcast, you can relax without shutting off your brain. Download the NPR app today.
Now let's add another voice to the conversation. John Lindsay Poland is the coordinator of Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico. That's a collaboration of Global Exchange, an international human rights organization, and the Mexican Commission for the Defense and Promotion of Human Rights. The organization aims to lower legal gun sales to Mexico and end illegal trafficking of firearms. John, welcome to the program.
Great. It's great to be with you, Jen.
Now, John, you founded the Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico program in 2017 after seeing a rise in violence in Mexico. What was behind that rise?
Well, we saw the rise with the declaration of the drug war by the Mexican government with U.S. support in 2006. That led to a fragmentation of elite criminal organizations in Mexico that then competed for control. But it was also a result in part of the end of the assault weapons ban in the United States in 2004, which allowed a lot more trafficking of assault weapons over the border, which are precisely, as Eva was saying, the kinds of weapons that these criminal organizations are desiring because they want military assets in order to control territory. That's how they make money, is by controlling territory. So these types of weapons that were suddenly more available in the United States were also part of it. But the drug war has definitely contributed to the rise in violence as well.
Do you see, well, let me read this comment from Jessica first, who says, it's tragic to know that our own national gun problem is spreading into Mexico. Recently, a lot of focus has been on the immigrant crisis in our southern borders. It appears that some of those immigrants are affected by gun violence from weapons originating from the states. These two issues are interrelated and causing a vicious and devastating cycle. What is frustrating to me is that policies do not seem to be targeting the root problems. As a result, gun violence, immigration, and other challenges are worsening. John, when you think about the past decade or so of your work, do you see links being made at the policy level between guns in the U.S. and violence in Mexico?
Not enough. You know, Angela was talking earlier about the ways that it's very difficult to check the traffic over the border. And part of that is because both countries have prioritized legal commerce over the border. But it's also because the infrastructure for control at the border is really about people moving from the south to the north, or drugs moving from the south to the north. The idea that the United States could be the source of violence or the source of problems, it has been drowned out by an anti-migrant rhetoric that, you know, certainly accelerated with President Trump's term, but I think has been present for a long time. It's been present since the 90s. And that is reflected in the enforcement strategies of both countries. Hmm. And so I do think that more of the connecting the dots, as Yeva said, needs to occur at the policy level, among communities, in the media, and among academics as well.
Weapons from the U.S. aren't just ending up in the hands of criminal organizations. A 2018 report by the Mexican Commission for the Defense and Promotion of Human Rights and Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico says that imported firearms have been used by Mexico's police and military in human rights abuses. In 2014, 43 students from a teaching college in Iguala, Mexico, disappeared after being attacked by local police armed with legally imported assault rifles. Mexican authorities say that those police turned them over to drug traffickers in Iguala. In 2022, Mexico's former attorney general and a top prosecutor in the case were charged with forced disappearance, torture, and obstruction of justice. Authorities that year issued arrest warrants for more than 80 people, including members of the military and the Mexican government. The motive behind the kidnapping remains unclear. 1A producer Barb Anguiano spoke to Antonio Tizapa, whose son Jorge Antonio is one of those missing students. Here's what he told us.
Este 26 se cumplirán 115 meses de la desaparición de nuestros hijos.
The 26th will be the 115th month of the disappearance of our children. There are lots of questions, one of which is, where are our children? Of course, it's been a while since we've known that there was military involvement and also some police at all levels and organized crime. But we haven't stopped fighting. We haven't got answers, but it's all we're hoping for.
¿Qué tanto anhelamos? Allá en México, ver a un policía, ver...
In Mexico, police and government are synonymous with oppression and fear. As you grow up, when you come across anyone representative of law enforcement with a weapon, it creates fear. They terrorize civilians with those weapons, like they've killed thousands with those weapons, thousands. And at this moment, I think about why the Mexican government has bought so many weapons and what we can do to stop the purchase of those weapons. There's a lot of things we don't know about.
Hay muchas cosas que realmente uno desconoce. Y la familia, no solamente la nuestra, sino la de los muchachos, está, pues siguen destrozadas.
As far as family, not just ours, but the families of all those young people whose lives have been destroyed, we want answers. We've said it time and time again. We want answers, even if it hurts, but we want the truth. Some of the mothers say that if there's no scientific evidence, there's no historic fact. If the government has evidence and facts to back up what they're saying, so be it. But it has to be scientifically based.
Pero que sea scientifically.
And again, that was Antonio Tizapa, whose son Jorge Antonio is one of the students missing from Iguala. John and Yeva, I'd love to hear from each of you how Antonio's story reflects the types of stories you've heard from other families impacted by violence in Mexico. Yeva, I'll come to you first.
It really resonated from what I've seen and what people told me. I think it's very hard for us in this country to understand. We do have police violence in the United States for sure, but we don't understand that in Mexico, people often fear the police even more than organized crime groups. You cannot trust them. They erect these checkpoints on the road sometimes, and they can kidnap or extort people just the same way as organized crime groups. There is like no boundary, as I said before. But also, we need to understand how this happens. So the police were also very, very underpaid, understaffed, undertrained, and they had access to weapons. So they were the first kind of target for recruitment for organized crime groups. When organized crime especially recently when there was this fracturing that happened and different groups started controlling different territories. And the other thing is, I think from this conversation too, is that what we are seeing is an arms race. Because organized crime groups have such powerful weapons, they cannot buy such guns in Mexico. So they turn to the United States. But then what does the Mexican government do? Well, then the military and the police, they also want more powerful weapons. And it just escalates this.
John, your thoughts?
Well, two things especially come to me. One is that from Don Antonio's story, the 43 disappeared from the Ayotzinapa College are among more than 100,000 people who have been forcibly disappeared in Mexico. Many of them are migrants who are transiting Mexico, but most are Mexicans, and most of them were forcibly disappeared, taken, kidnapped, and then their bodies never appeared through actions with guns. But the body never shows up. The guns never show up. There's nothing in evidence. And so often they are invisible when we talk about gun violence, even though the phenomenon is overwhelming and enormous. And it's a crime that doesn't end because the body is, there's no prosecution, but also there's no body, there's no grave for the loved ones to grieve at. But the other thing that's really important, I think, about this is that most guns exported legally by the United States to Mexico, they go to the Mexican Army, and the Mexican Army sells them to police. That's most U.S. exported guns are going to police, which have all of these problems of collusion with organized crime that Ieva described. In addition, in that particular case, the Guerrero State Police, who were involved in the disappearance of those 43 students and had guns exported from cults in Connecticut, the United States approved more exports to the Guerrero State Police after that crime. And that's occurred in other parts of the country as well. There was a disappearance of 19 migrants in northern Mexico in Tamaulipas in 2021 that was carried out by Tamaulipas State Police. They got more guns, in this case from Sig Sauer, after that that crime was committed and after the police were implicated in the crime. So there's not a control on the U.S. side for where these weapons are going when they're legally exported. And that's something that really needs to be implemented. It could be implemented from the executive branch through policy or through legislation, but it's really important that we know where the guns are going, who the users are, and that there's a control on them to exclude them going to state forces that are implicated in crimes of any kind.
Angela, when you are out reporting, what are you hearing from people like Antonio about how, if at all, they feel they can address this issue within the country themselves as citizens?
Well, people often feel powerless, but there are lots of brave people, especially women, mothers, wives, sisters of the disappeared, who are out there pressuring Mexico's government to prosecute these cases, to also speak out about the guns. And bravely, I say, because often they themselves are threatened. So people want to take action, and they're doing that. But it is very, very difficult and very dangerous.
Yeah, but what additional work do you think needs to be done at a policy level to stop this flow of guns into Mexico?
Well, I think the Binational Secure Communities Act is a good first step, but it's we need to address both the supply and the demand. So we need to think about how to make manufacturers responsible gun companies. We need to have background checks on all sales, on private sales that are arranged via the internet, on gun shows. Perhaps we need more inspections on the border that are southbound, although that is really, it's hard to do because of how we prioritize trade and everything goes through ports of entry. But a very, very important aspect of this is that we need to work with Mexico, and Mexico has to reform its criminal justice system. It has to make police accountable for the crimes they committed and create trust between citizens and law enforcement institutions. Without that, it will be very hard to get out of this vicious circle.
John, I'll give you the last word here, especially if you're seeing places where you think progress is being made.
Well, I think the lawsuit that Mexico has filed is a very important step and should be continued. I also think that for all of us, whether in government or not, putting human rights above gun rights is key. People should have more rights than things, and that could guide us going forward.
That's John Lindsay Poland, the coordinator of Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico, a collaboration of Global Exchange in the United States and the Mexican Commission for the Defense and Promotion of Human Rights in Mexico. Also with us, Angela Cocherga, news director and correspondent at KTEP at the University of Texas in El Paso. That's El Paso's NPR station. And Yeva Yusinite. She's an anthropologist and former paramedic. She's also author of the new book, Exit Wounds, How America's Guns Fuel Violence Across the Border. It's out now. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Arfi Getty with help from Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you're carrying around a lot of stress, therapy is a safe space to get it off your chest. If you're considering therapy, give BetterHelp a try at betterhelp.com/NPR to get 10% off your first month.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.